Welcome, everyone. It's Beverly Tomasian. I'm really excited to be here today. It's our final boot camp for the CDE exam, and it's been a lot of fun for me to reach out to all of you and share this information and get your questions. And I've learned a lot putting this program together, especially this session, because as you know, I'm a registered nurse. And nutrition is not something that I specialize in. As a diabetes educator, I'm very familiar with it. I have to know about it. But it's not what I live, eat, and breathe all day long. So as I was researching for this talk, I also, just like you, had to look at the ADA guidelines for MNT, and I had to look at the big book and kind of synthesize the most critical points. And it's a lot of information. So if you feel like, wow, this is a lot to figure out what to study, I agree with you. And I think that's why I feel so passionate about this boot camp, because for all of us out there, we are, you know, really having to juggle a lot of different things in our life. And how do we study most effectively for this exam while at the same time really improving as diabetes educators? And so this boot camp is designed for that, to say, hey, these are the really important things you need to know for your clinical practice, and will also help you in the exam. So that's our goal with this. It's really twofold. And so it was a joy for me. I am sorry. I'm going to apologize that I didn't get the handouts till late last night, but I was working on them all day long yesterday. So with that in mind, let's get going, and I'm right there with you all. What are we going to talk about today in Boot Camp 5? We're going to talk about new nutrition guidelines and exercise guidelines. And in your reference page last night, I put two articles that I can't encourage you enough to read them. It's the MNT guidelines. They were published late in 2013. They were republished in 2014. The ones I have posted up there are the most recent guidelines, and also the exercise guidelines. It was a joint collaboration between ADA and the Exercise Council, and they talked about what are the guidelines for people with diabetes as far as exercise. I would definitely read those too. And so I find these articles really synthesize a lot of information very deftly. They say these are the important things to know, and it can really help decrease the volume of material you have to read compared to the art and science book. So I'm, you know, trying to provide these resources for you to help you succeed and gather this information in a way that's expeditious, but also that really informs. So that's the goal here. I read these guidelines too, and it just, here they are. I've just put a new a PowerPoint slide for them. I read these guidelines too because they're really important for my practice. The other thing I have review ADA standards of care, which we talked about on the first time. Review the exchange list, and I did put a link to the exchange list, and you say, do I have to memorize this exchange list? Well, it's kind of impossible to memorize it all, but you want to be familiar with key points, and I'm going to point out some key points. And as a diabetes educator myself, you know, I teach about carb counting and portion control every day I work with patients. And so over time, you just become familiar with portion sizes and, you know, different foods and carb counting. I just got this from the outline for CDE. What do we need to know about MNT and exercise? And after I copied this outline and pasted it for you, but it's right there in your outline as part of your resources, I put together this slideshow based on these. So this is what they're going to test you on. This is what can be included in the exam. And so I've tried to cover and hit on most of these details. And if I didn't cover some, I just didn't have enough time to do it in an hour and a half. So you can go and, you know, look that information up on your own as you read through those different articles. It'll be really, really helpful for you. So get that highlighter out, get a comfortable chair, and just go through those articles and, you know, see what they have to say. And just talking about nutrition and exercise, here's the scale. And the scale can be the friend or the foe. But we definitely know, as far as weight loss goes, weighing yourself on a regular basis has been shown, you know, through studies and evidence-based information, that regular weighing helps people maintain body weight or lose body weight, even though you might feel like shooting the scale sometime. And just kind of interesting, this was from an article that appeared in the Cancer Journal. It was called Obesity and Epidemic and economics, obesity and economics. You can Google it. It was such a great article, and I'll try and put it in your resources today. But what it looked at is how are we doing with obesity in America? And we definitely know that 68% of us are overweight or obese, 34% with a BMI of 30 and above, and 34% overweight with a BMI of 25 to 29. But as you know, just because you're overweight doesn't mean you're going to get diabetes, and we definitely do move less during the day. And interestingly enough, compared to our income, food costs have gone down. Before 1970, relative to income, food costs a lot more. But this is really important. Caloric intake is on the rise. In 1970, we were eating about 2,000 calories a day. And now you can see we're up to 2,600 calories a day. So if we want an explanation behind our increased body weight, that might be one of the reasons. There's all kinds of other reasons that I'm going to talk about in a free webinar I have coming in 2 weeks called New Horizons in Diabetes. Some environmental influences that might be increasing our weight too. But here's a really nice visual image of BMI. And I think this really kind of shows where as the weight gains, the visceral adiposity is certainly increasing, and with that increase in visceral adiposity comes the increased risk of diabetes. And just to know these ranges, a BMI of in the 17s, underweight, BMI 18.5 to 25, normal, 30 is overweight, and BMI 40, 35 and above is considered, you know, seriously obese. So those are good to know for the exam. And I just put a BMI chart in here that talks about those same levels of body weight. So just for your information. The other thing that we're really worried about is that the average American consumes 25 teaspoons of sugar a day, 400 calories. And there has been a lot of legislation proposed to put warning label on sodas, to, you know, put a sugar tax, all kinds of public health initiatives to help decrease consumption of sugary drinks, none of which have really taken off because Americans, you know, don't want us to impose public health laws to improve health. They want it and the right of the individual. But we have a serious diabetes epidemic in America, and maybe we need to rethink that a little bit. I do want to point out the ADA guidelines. Now, the American Diabetes Association, which is very conservative in their standards of care starting in 2013, did say limit sodas and beverages with sugar and high fructose corn syrup. So that is really a bold statement for them to say, we need to tell our patients to limit these sugary beverages. And I'm sure you just heard the recent news where sugary sodas decrease life expectancy by 4.5 years because they shorten the telomeres in the cell. So this might be affecting us from more than a weight gain perspective. Maybe soda does something unique that actually is even more harmful than the extra calories. But we have to keep a look on the evidence and keep looking at studies till we really gather that and say that for sure. But you need to know for the exam the difference between caloric sweeteners and the non-caloric. So caloric sweeteners mean they contain calories, and they're called nutritive sweeteners, sucrose and fructose, so sucrose, white, table sugar. And the ADA came out about maybe 15 years ago and saying that a person with diabetes can include sucrose as part of their diet. It doesn't increase glucose more than a similar amount of starch. So sucrose is, you know, can be included as long as you count it as a carbohydrate. You can include it, but avoid excess sucrose intake. Also, fructose as a sweetener is not recommended since it may adversely affect lipids, but that's added fructose. Fructose added to beverages to sweeten it, but they do say that naturally occurring fructose is okay, just in the fruit. The reduced calorie sweetener, so these do have calories, but less calories are the sugar alcohols. They're not completely absorbed, so you absorb about half of the nutrition from them. But they do have unpleasant side effects, diarrhea, bloating, and gas. So if patients choose to eat these are like the See's candies, they'll say sugar-free. They don't have any white, when it says sugar-free, it means no white table sugar, but they can still use these other type of sugar alcohols and call it sugar-free. So read the label if it has any of these in it. These are considered caloric sweeteners, and they can cause gas, and some people can tolerate them better than others. So this depends on your digestive system. Now, here are the non-nutritive sweeteners. These have no calories. There's FDA 6 approved for use, and here I've listed them. So here's the FDA stance, is that there's no indication they will cause weight loss or weight gain, and they're safe for public, people with diabetes, and pregnant women. So I got that right from the FDA website. So you, I know all of you here have heard about the latest news where they're saying, you know, maybe these sweeteners can alter your gut bacteria, maybe these sweeteners, artificial sweeteners, make you want to eat more sugar and other sweet foods. So that is not going to be on the exam. For the exam, you need to know this information. This is what the current science says, that the FDA says they're still approved for use. So that is really important to keep in mind. So let's talk about medical nutrition therapy, ADA 2014. And what they say here is that there's no ideal percentage of calories from protein, carbohydrate, and fat for people with diabetes. The macronutrient, that's the protein, fat, and carbs, should be, distribution should be based on individualized assessment of eating patterns, preferences, and metabolic goals. So this has been out for a while, that we don't know. The science hasn't told us. Evidence has not told us, you know, what is the right balance of these macronutrients. So we have to always think about individualizing how much macronutrients we, you know, advise people to eat based on what? Their metabolic goals and preferences, getting back to preferences and eating patterns. So we always start where the patient is at, and then we kind of help them, you know, through coaching, modify the way they're eating and look at their metabolic goals too. So the first thing we're going to do is assess. We're going to assess their eating patterns, and we're going to look at preference. We just talked about this. Their timing, snacks, environment. We're going to look at disordered eating. And so many of my patients, you know, they say, Bev, I don't really eat breakfast. And sometimes that's not my first goal. I mean, I want people to eat breakfast, but what I'll say is, let's just start where you're at and modify the way you're eating to get you to a healthier place. And then we could come back and talk about, you know, adding breakfast in. So it really depends on the patient and what's going on in their life, because each one of us is unique. Be yourself. Everybody else is already taken. I love this Oscar Wilde quote. You know, when we work with our patients, kind of the underpinning of the exam is they all bring their history, their relationship with food, with their culture, the way they do it to the table. And I think the DCCT was so awesome because it said, we're going to match the insulin to the way you eat. You tell us how you eat, what your pattern is, what your daily life looks like, and we're going to match insulin to that and just work within your life space. And they had a lot better success that way. The other thing we want to think about when we're talking to our patients is the relationship with food. And I love this mindful eating plate. You can download it yourself. It's from Susan Albers. And she's saying, take time to savor the food. Be aware of tasting versus mindless munching. Speak kindly and mindfully to yourself and be in the moment. Turn off that TV and really sit and enjoy that meal. And I love this, observe. For a lot of our patients with diabetes, since they don't make enough of that gut hormone, they may not get a sense of fullness. So notice your body. Are you full? Are you hungry? Have you eaten enough? Can you stop now? Are you eating because of emotions? Are you eating because you're genuinely hungry? And I think of all the things we teach our patients about eating and their relationship with food, this mindfulness is really very important. It can help them a lot. So medical nutrition therapy, this again just comes right from the guidelines, and these are things you want to know for the exam. Focus on the individual. I love this. Maintain pleasure of eating, because I feel like the first thing patients always say is, like, you're going to take away all my favorite food. No, we're going to make sure to incorporate your favorite food into your meal plan. I will guarantee that, and I hold true to my promise. So if we take away everything and they feel deprived, many times they just want to abandon their meal plan. So we always need to consider that. Provide positive messages about food. Lots of times when patients go on insulin and they gain weight as a result of that, because when your blood sugar is 300 and it goes down to 150, you're going to gain weight. I say this is a sign of your body healing. You're bringing nutrition into your body, and your body is moving toward health. So positive messages about food. I love this next one. Limit food choices only when backed by science. We used to tell people, don't eat sugar. Look, here's a tear-off page. Don't eat all these foods. It wasn't backed on science. We just felt like diabetes, don't eat sugar. We need to give them practical tools, very important tools that they can take home and immediately use with them. And refer to a dietitian in diabetes education. Dietitians, I have this right here, RDs rock. I mean, they can lower A1C by 1 to 2 percentage point. And so here I've listed what patients with diabetes should do as far as meeting with a diabetes educator and the dietitian. Very important. And they don't only need initial RD encounters, they need ongoing to help them maintain healthy eating, because I had a group the other day and they're like, this diabetes is going to last for a lifetime. Yeah, it does. So we need to provide them with ongoing support. So approach to diabetes and meal planning depends on the patient. And if they have new type 2 diabetes, we're probably not going to do carb counting. I think this is really important. This comes right out of the guidelines. If you have new type 2, we're going to look at portion control, plate method, record keeping, and education. And as you know, just documenting your blood sugar, what you eat, and your blood sugars in relation to that will help people change the way they eat. Just the fact of writing down the food you eat and drink, anything you put in your mouth, we know helps people lose weight if they make that commitment. But if they're on insulin, we're going to have to be a little bit, approach it differently, because if you're on insulin, you're going to need to match your insulin to the carbs that you take, and you might need to do some postprandial checks. Now, what if you're only on basal insulin? Well, then we may not have to worry so much about carb counting. We may worry more about these issues. So we just want to be mindful about what we ask patients to do. So the nutrition guidelines, the ADA and Academy of Dietetic Recommendations is what we're going to focus on today. We're going to look at carbs, fats, protein, food and medication integration. I feel like we covered that quite a bit in our last programs. And then I'm looking at food tables. So I would put a star by this. This is the new recommendations as far as sodium, fat, and fiber. Sodium, try and keep less than 2,300 milligrams a day. We used to differentiate between people with diabetes and people without diabetes. We don't do that anymore. They didn't find that the sodium restriction for people with diabetes really improved outcomes. So this is the guidelines. Of course, we look at every patient individually, and if they have a real high risk for a heart attack or stroke and they're hypertensive, we might say, let's get your sodium down, but based on the individual. The other thing they say is vitamin and mineral supplements, not recommended. There's no good evidence that supports it. And I know when you do your recall and what medications they're taking or supplements, a lot of our patients are paying a lot of money for vitamin and mineral supplements with no good evidence to back that up. So we're not going to say, hey, stop taking those, but you might want to say, you know, if you're really struggling financially, maybe we could take a look at getting these micronutrients from food sources. That might be a way that you can look at that too. So based on the patient. Fat, okay, really important. This changed in 2013-14. Same as recommended for the general population. So you may ask, what should I study for this exam? Should I study old recommendations or new recommendations? Always study the latest recommendations. They may not, if it just changed the recommendation, they may not include it on the exam, but they could. So just be familiar with the latest recommendations. You know, the CDE exam writers know stuff changed that last year, so they're going to incorporate that. Anyways, it says less than 10% saturated fat, limit trans fat, less than 300 milligrams of cholesterol a day, and Mediterranean diet looks like a good option. And then here's fiber goal, 25 to 38 grams a day. Man, most Americans are lucky if they get 15 grams a day. So we have a lot of work to do on the fiber intake. So the ADA recommendation, eat less junk food and sugary drinks. Again, the ADA is coming out and saying, we need to make a difference here. Less processed foods, less sugary beverages, because it looks like these sugary beverages increase visceral adiposity. If they're sweetened with sugar or high fructose corn syrup, doesn't matter. Let's really take a look at talking to our patients about drinking less of these sodas. I know you all do. It's kind of one of those things that drive us all crazy. So teaching about eating healthy, here's some different strategy. Major food groups, we could talk about, you know, major food groups and portion control. We could look at the plate method, exchange list, food diaries. We're going to look at what is best given the situation. And certainly, I know you've seen the myplate.gov. And this might work for some of our patients, especially when trying to encourage a higher intake of vegetables and whole grains and limiting that protein. And myplate.gov is a great website. Patients can go there and get a lot of good information and get a customized meal plan for themselves and kind of see how much calories they're taking in. It's a real nice interactive site. So balancing your calories. Enjoy your food, but eat less. I like that. Avoid oversized portions. You know, don't go back for more. Just get the one plate. Get a smaller plate. Make your plate half fruits and vegetables. And for us, you know, if the patient's trying to manage blood sugars, we may not want to encourage fruit with a meal. We want to maybe encourage fruit in between meals. So we're going to individualize this plate. But I like this. Make at least half your grains, whole grains, and switch to the lower fat milk. And look for sodium in the meals and the packaged food. You know, most of our sodium doesn't come from salt shakers. It comes from processed foods. And drink water instead of sugary drinks. I personally like this plate better. You can Google, you know, plates and find all kinds of different ones. And this one, I love this. They actually put the number of inches, how large the plate was, which is 9 pulgadas, 9 inches. But look at, they put half the vegetables, some beautiful beans and arroz and, you know, chicken. So, and then I love that they put water to drink and fruit. So when we sit down with our patient, we're looking at evidence-based information, but we also bring our own personalities to the table too, right? Like how we see a nutrition. And so as long as we see nutrition in a way that matches the guidelines, I think we're okay, and it certainly does. But we want to do things that philosophically match with us too. So here's how nutrients affect blood sugar. As you can see, carbohydrates are the one that raise blood sugar and sustain it. So carbohydrates are an important part of our intake to keep our energy levels up, and it feeds our muscles and all of that important stuff. So carbohydrates within, you know, 10 to 15 minutes of eating, we're going to see this spike up. And you can see after about an hour to 2 hours, the carbohydrates, you know, the effect on our blood glucose really waxes and wanes. So that's why we have patients check their blood sugar 1 to 2 hours after a meal, because we want to see after the meal how well their blood sugar responded. How did their pancreas respond to that carbohydrate bolus, and how is the medication working? You can see that protein doesn't really raise blood sugar. You see it goes up a little bit, but it never really causes hyperglycemia. And as a matter of fact, we'll talk about this more in a minute, that protein might actually stimulate the pancreas to make insulin and potentiate low blood sugar, interestingly enough. So protein foods might actually have some benefit in stimulating the pancreas to make insulin. And here, as you know, fat are excellent satiator. It just hangs out for a while. And this might be called the pizza effect, that if you eat pizza with a lot of fat in it, sometimes patients will say, hey, my blood sugar went up a little bit, you know, 4 hours after. That might be the fat kind of blocking absorption of the carbs or delaying it. So who knows? You know what? Patients tell me all kinds of stuff, and I just basically say, you have your own glycemic index in your body. You respond to glucose, carbohydrates, medications in your own way. So let's figure out your pattern. That's the most important thing. So carbs do affect post-meal glucose. This is important to keep in mind. When we have patients check their blood sugar after a meal, we're trying to figure out what affected that post-meal glucose, because there's three things that affect post-meal glucose. It's the carbohydrates you ate, it's your activity level, and it's the medications. So certainly these starchy foods do contribute to post-meal hyperglycemia. And we did used to talk about simple carbs and complex carbs. They don't really talk about that anymore. So we just basically talk about carbohydrates, and carbohydrates are sugars and starches and fruit and milk, all that stuff. So let's do a poll. What do y'all say? I did have a typo in one of my polls, the first one I'm doing, so I fixed it. I want to know, how many grams of carb are in the following food sampling? And I should have put 3/4 cups of berries. It's 3/4 cups of berries, so I apologize. That was my mistake. So how would you know the answer to this? Well, you would look at the exchange list and kind of calculate it out. So I know you all have that exchange list available to you if you want to look at it right now. And then you just want to add up the carbs. Would they ask this kind of question on the exam? You just need to know really which the most, how much carbs are in the most common foods. So I don't know how they're going to word it exactly, but they want to know that you know what is generally one serving of carbohydrate. Okay. Or how much food, you know, equals one serving of carbohydrate of the common foods. Let's go ahead and close this poll. Thank you so much for voting, everybody. So I'm just going to say that 55% of you chose 51 grams. Could that be the right answer? It's looking pretty good. So let's go over that together. So if you chose that, hang on. If you chose something else, let's think about that. So, as I mentioned, this there was a typo in this, so this is my fault, but I fixed it, but I don't have the right slideshow up right now, so you're going to have to hang in with me. How many grams of carb is in the following breakfast? So, 1 cup of oatmeal. So, generally, you know that a half a cup of cereal, that's just a general rule, is 15 grams of carbohydrate. So, 1 cup of oatmeal is 30 grams. So, that's just a good thing to keep in mind when you're looking at that exchange list. A half cup of cereal is 15 grams. A piece of bread is 15 grams. So that's 30. And then milk. We need to know that one serving of milk, a cup of milk, is 12 grams of carbohydrate. So half of that is 6 grams. So now we have 30 plus 6. Now that should have said 3/4 cup of berries. And 3/4 cup of berries is 15 grams of carbohydrates. So we have 30 plus 15 is 45 plus 6, 51 grams of carbohydrate. So if you chose 51 grams, you're absolutely right. And what if you didn't choose it? It just tells you that you need to go back and get more familiar with that exchange list and, you know, just kind of study the most common foods. Now, this is kind of an interesting slide. It says each meal, what are the carbohydrate needs for most adults? And this is what we've kind of taught for a long time, 45 to 60 grams per meal, which is 3 to 4 servings, and 15 to 30 grams for the snack, which is 1 to 2 servings. Now, I just read to you the slide that said there is no recommended macronutrient, you know, amount for adults. So this is not for the exam. This is just patients ask me how much should I eat per serving and generally per meal of carbohydrates. And generally I'll say, you know, about 3 servings if you're a woman, 4 servings if you're a man. I'm just giving you a ballpark that you can use in your own practice. And this is not for exam, just a framework. Now, if you look at the recommended daily allowance, the RDA, this is the government, they say we should have at least 130 grams of carbohydrate a day. That's what they say we should, you know, the minimum amount per day. Will that show up on the exam? I don't know. It might. But the RDA is different. The recommended daily allowance is different than the American Diabetes Association guidelines. But they're guidelines that we often use as educators because we just want to know what is the general rule of thumb for people. So that might seem confusing to you. It's confusing to me because the American Diabetes Association says, you know, there's no definite macronutrient distribution, but yet the RDA is saying, well, here's some guidelines. So I will be familiar with both of those for your practice and for the exam. Oh, here's a diabetes exchange list. So I just wanted to show this to you to help you figure out what to study. You just want to know that in starches, there's 15 grams of carbohydrate per servings and about 80 calories. In meat, As you know, there's protein and fat, and there's a caloric distribution. And vegetables, there's about 5 grams of carbohydrate per serving and some protein, as you know. And then fruit, it's 15 grams of carb with 60 calories per serving. So you can see the fruit, it has less calories than the starches. And then here's milk, about 12 grams of carbohydrate per serving, and depending on the type of milk, there's a different amount of fat and calories. So those are just some general things you want to be familiar with for the exam that is good to know. And what I've done in the next slides here is I've done carb counting assigned for starches. These are just common amounts of different starches. And these are good things just to be familiar with for the exam. 1/3 cup of pasta, 1/2 cup of corn, 1/2 cup of beans, 1/3 of a cup of rice. That comes up on the exam a lot of times. 1/2 English muffin and a small potato. Now here's fruit. Each food in this picture has 60 calories and 15 grams of carb. So this is good to know. I just put some of the most common ones you would want to be familiar with. And look at this. 1 1/4 cup of strawberries, 17 small grapes, 2 tablespoons of raisins, and 1 cup of melon. So many people tell me, I can't eat melon, I have diabetes. I'm like, enjoy the melon, it's wonderful. And then here's carbohydrates as far as milk goes. For an 8-ounce glass of milk, generally 12 grams of carbohydrate. If you look at yogurts or things that have sugar added in, the carbohydrates are going to go up, of course. So this is just something to be familiar with also. So this might be a nice little flashcard for you. You could, you know, cut this out, make a flashcard, and then, of course, for you dietitians, you're like, oh, you know, you all know this is so easy. You're like probably taking a nap right now. So thank you, dietitians, for all the great stuff you do. But for those of us who are not dietitians, there's just, we have to go through the exercise of memorizing certain things. And of course, when our patients ask us, we want to know. But here's Jell-O, 1/2 cup, 1/2 cup of diet pudding, small cookies. Here's ice cream. And then here's sorbet. You'll hear a lot of people say, oh, eat sorbet, but it actually has more sugar than ice cream because you can only have 1/4 cup. And then here is the jam. Tablespoon of jam. So we want to really encourage our patients to choose healthy carbs, carbs that have fiber, vitamins, mineral, and phytonutrients. We're working toward that 25 grams of fiber a day. And here's some of the power carbs. Wow, these are part of the superfood category. Bean, veggies, fruit, whole grain foods. I love this picture. And I just constantly am talking to my patients about how to integrate these foods into their meal plan. And these foods aren't even expensive if you buy them in season. Beans are $1 a bag. And so these foods can really nourish our bodies and improve our health in so many different ways. And many of our patients have gotten misinformation about these foods. But I just want to mention one other thing is that many of these foods also help to keep our intestinal bacteria and good happy. So they're really good for our intestinal bacteria, which are really important in helping prevent inflammation and disease expression and is helping us maintain health. 10 superfoods. I just got these from the American Diabetes Association, and I love these superfoods. I'm encouraging, again, my patients to move toward the tomato. Choose these healthier foods, and you will not only improve your diabetes management, but also improve your overall health. Look at right now, sweet potatoes. I actually call sweet potatoes the ultimate fast food because you can throw those in the microwave and just eat them as a meal. You know, so terrific. The other thing the exam asks us to be familiar with is food labels. And, you know, teaching our patients about food labels, wow, so important. They're confusing to read. Hopefully, in the near future, we'll see the food labels simplified. There's legislation now to update this food label. But, of course, you know, the food companies don't want it updated and simplified. They like it being confusing for patients because they like to trick people to buy their food product. So the serving size is often the issue, that the serving size is like, we'll say, 1/8 of a cup. You know, and there's 8 servings in that bag. They do that because when they put the calories of 100, They don't want to. So 1/8 of a cup is 100 calories. If they put the true serving size, which is a bag, it would be 800 calories. So they don't want to put that on the label to scare people away. Anyways, that's a whole nother political talk. But you want to look for sure at the serving size, half a cup, and how many servings per container. We want to look at the total carbohydrate. Patients get really confused. They look at the sugar. Yes, look at the sugar. You want to be familiar with how much sugar is thrown in there, especially added sugar. But you want to look at total carbohydrate per serving. That's the most important part. 1/2 cup is 13 grams. This is about one serving of carbohydrate. What else are they going to look at? They're also going to look, sorry about that. They're also going to look at the fat and the saturated fat. So we definitely want to stay away from foods with, you know, a lot of saturated fat and avoid foods with trans fat. And we want to look at dietary fiber. You know, 3 grams is decent. But if it says, you know, less than 1 gram, that food doesn't have much fiber in it at all. We're trying to accumulate at least 25 grams of fiber. So we want to really increase our intake of foods that do have fiber. So looking at a food label, really important. And I did put this app here. I love this app. It's called Fooducate. And I have it on my iPhone. And when I go grocery shopping with my kids who want to buy the junk food cereal, I say use this Fooducate app because you can take your phone and scan the food and it will give you the nutrition of that food and give it a rating, A, B, C, or D. And I tell my kids, only a B plus or better am I going to buy that cereal. So it saves a lot of fighting in the supermarket. But even for my own self, when I'm looking at foods, I'm like, how healthy are these? It's a really nice app to use. So we're going to talk about fat a little bit, and let's do a poll here. Which of the following foods has the most saturated fat? Oh, Vilma wants to know, do I have any of these slides in color? They are good slides, aren't they, Vilma? Yeah, I could post them in color for you guys. That would be my pleasure to do so. If you want to print them out and share them with your patients, that'll be great. Okay, 81% of you have voted, so I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. This is very interesting. So I'm going to share your answers with you. So 20% of you chose salmon as the right answer. 12% chose olives, 32% chose peanuts, and 36% chose soybean oil. So if you look at the exchange list and look at which of the foods, which of these oils are saturated versus non-saturated, it is the right answer is salmon. Salmon has the most saturated fat. Now, this is interesting because salmon is an animal. And I always tell my patients, if it had a mother, it has cholesterol and saturated fat in it. These plant-based oils, we don't consider them to have saturated fat. So it is the salmon that has the most saturated fat per ounce because it is an animal fat. Now you can say, well, salmon's a healthy food. Oh, absolutely. It's very healthy, full of omega-3 fatty acids. So just because it has saturated fat doesn't mean it's a bad food. We just want to make sure we limit the saturated fat to less than 10% of our intake. So this is a really important thing to keep in mind. People think, you know, chicken is better than pork, but they both have saturated fat and cholesterol in them. So any animal product is going to have saturated fat. The plant-based products don't, unless you look at the coconut oils and the tropical oils, but these do not. Okay, so let's keep moving on. Fat from ADA 2014 standards. This is, again, talking about we don't know the ideal amount of total fat intake for people with diabetes. We need to individualize the goals And it's the quality that appears to be more important than the quantity. Interesting. So we want to look at the amount of dietary, saturated fat, cholesterol, and trans fat and limit those. And the recommendations are the same as the general population, which we talked about earlier. Less than 300 milligrams of cholesterol and less than 10% of the intake from saturated fat. People with this is interesting. This was from the ADA guidelines, and I didn't know this. People with diabetes on average get 45% of calories from carbohydrates, 30 to 40% from fat, and about, 15 to 20% from protein. So people with diabetes, are getting a lot of their calories from fat. And if we look at the contribution fat intake has to weight gain, we know that fat is more calorie dense than the other macronutrients. So that might be a really nice place for us to start with patients, looking at carbs always, because carbs affect blood glucose. But we know that one of the most important things to do is help patients lose weight. And in the diabetes prevention program, they actually did encourage patients to cut back their fat intake as a first step to weight loss, which I thought was really interesting. So the guidelines from ADA, I had a little typo here, so I changed the arrow to go the other direction. You can change it on your handout. Limit saturated fats to less than 10% of calories. Limit trans fat as much as possible, and look at total dietary cholesterol. So the thing about fat, it has 9 calories per gram. It has double the calorie density of carbohydrate and protein. So we just want to keep that in mind. It doesn't make it good or bad. It's just information. We do want to move toward the monounsaturated and the polyunsaturated fats, the plant-based fat. You can see they actually lower total cholesterol and LDL and raise HDL, and they're high in omega-3 fatty acids. That's the monos. And the polys help lower total cholesterol and the LDLs. The saturated fats we really want to limit, and they are solid at room temperature. And here's a serving size. People tell me, oh, I have an avocado for lunch. So you just might want to, rethink the amount of avocado you're eating. Even though it's a healthy fat, we still have to look at portion control. So my very excellent friend and wonderful colleague, Dana Armstrong, says, consider fat a condiment. It's a condiment. It's not the main part of the meal. It's something that we add a little bit of to add flavor. The greatest thing about fat, as it satiates us. It makes us have a sense of fullness. Humans love fat. We look for fat. It's a very desirable food ingredient for us because it just tastes good. It's creamy usually, and it does give us a sense of fullness. Here's some of the unhealthy dietary fats. The trans fat. Strong link between diets high in trans fat and heart disease. It lowers our good cholesterol, increases the bad cholesterol, may actually increase abdominal fat and weight gain, and contribute to type 2 diabetes. So look for, now the labeling is better. It has to show if there's trans fats in there. But looking on label for words hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated would also let your patients know that there's actually trans fats included. Let's talk about protein. So protein's pretty controversial. I would say, food is controversial because there's new evidence emerging all the time about food. And it adds to our patients' confusion. We're confused as healthcare professionals. Imagine how confused they are. So the newest recommendations for protein say that for people with diabetes and no diabetes kidney disease, evidence is inconclusive for ideal amount of protein. Therefore, goals should be individualized. So again, we're not getting any numbers from the American Diabetes Association or the American Dietetic Association, but we do get numbers from the recommended daily allowance from the government. So I left that in there. I don't know if it's going to be on the exam, but I would just be familiar with it. It's kind of that standard number you'll see. I've been seeing it for years. And the RDA recommends 0.8 grams of good quality protein per kilogram per day. And that's just kind of a general guideline. It's probably not backed up by good science as far as we know currently, but that's kind of a general starting place that we might use to calculate how much protein does a person need a day. And then we're going to individualize it from there. Interestingly, I mentioned this earlier, protein seems to stimulate insulin response. Do not use to treat hypoglycemia. That is in the medical nutrition guidelines. And I just got a note from a provider that said, hey, when this patient's low, give them some, you know, protein. And I'm like, no, protein is not the right thing to treat it because it actually might stimulate further insulin production and hypoglycemia. So we want to make sure we give our people carbs. Look at this. For those with kidney failure, reducing the amount of dietary protein is not recommended. There's no evidence to say that it improves outcome. And if you're like me, we have heard the opposite for the past 20 years. So this is new information for us that, you know, we used to say go down on the grams of protein per day for kidney failure to protect the kidneys, but there's no good evidence to support that. So I would know that and be familiar with that, and that's right in the guidelines. Okay, let's move on to protein. Well, we're on it already, but keep talking about protein. You can see protein is a lot less calorie dense than fat. It only has 4 calories per gram. And protein includes poultry, fish, eggs, beef, plant sources, bean, lentils, and nuts. So we can get protein from meat, from nuts, and from cheeses and milk and so forth. We want to really help our patients to limit the high fat proteins. And here's serving size. So generally, patients might want to have 7 ounces of protein per day, which would be 3 ounces is the size of the palm of your hand. It's, you know, half a chicken breast, a small chicken breast, about just the size of the palm of your hand and the thickness of a deck of cards. So that's just kind of helpful for patients to keep in mind. It's not that huge, you know, 12-ounce steak. That's not a serving of protein. That's like a lot more than anyone would need for one meal. So again, making it so that the fruits and the vegetables and the whole grains are more the focus of the meal, and protein's just another part of the meal, but not the main event. It can really help our patients because you know what? Most proteins do have some saturated fat, especially the animal-based protein. So we know that protein and fat are often coexisting. Let's talk a little bit now about alcohol, weight management, and some of the complications associated with diabetes, gastroparesis, celiac disease, and bariatric surgery. And before we go on, let's do one more poll. You know what? Okay. Well, you'll have to look at your handout because I just put as much as I could about Alice in here, but let me read the situation. And that's on your slides, poll question 3. Alice has type 1, drank 4 rum and Cokes, and ate some snacks. She took 3 units of insulin via her pump. Her blood glucose is 162 before she goes to bed. But drinking alcohol puts Alice at risk for what? So she had 4 rum and Cokes and ate some snacks. She's got type 1 diabetes. And to cover that, she took 3 units of insulin. Her before meal blood glucose is 162. So what is she at risk for? Okay, thank you all for voting. So like many of our patients, Alice has type 1. She's out partying with her friends, rum and Coke, snacks. She's feeling kind of loopy. She's like, oh, my blood sugar is 162. She takes 3 units of insulin via her pump. What is she going to do? What is she at risk for? Okay, most of you have voted, so let's go ahead and take a look at this. Thanks, you guys, for voting. I appreciate it. Okay, so some of you chose DKA due to ketone production associated with alcohol, and nobody chose hyperglycemia. Great job. B, 4% of you said hyperglycemia from alcohol and appetizers, but the majority of you chose hypoglycemia. So I just want to let you know that alcohol does cause low blood sugar. That's the number one thing we're worried about with alcohol. Even though she had rum and Coke, she had a lot of rum, that rum and Coke. And so initially from the carbohydrates, from her snacks, that blood sugar might go up. But those 4 drinks have a long-lasting impact in causing low blood sugar. Because you know why, you guys? Let me just go to the next slide. Is that alcohol stops the production of glycogen. It stops the release of glycogen from the liver. So there's no glycogenolysis happening during the night. When your liver is busy metabolizing alcohol, it's not able to release glucose into the bloodstream. Number one reason. Number two reason is that alcohol actually stimulates the pancreas to make insulin. I read this article maybe 3 years ago. Really good evidence to show that alcohol stimulates pancreatic insulin release. So now you have this combination of the pancreas squirting out more insulin. Well, she doesn't have insulin to be released. She has type 1, but for our type 2s, actually. And also, the more important thing is that alcohol stops the liver from releasing its glycogen stores. So hypoglycemia and alcohol is the biggest issue. And so based on this, women, this is the American Diabetes Association guidelines for alcohol intake. It does not say do not drink alcohol if you have diabetes, and a lot of our patients think that. It's one or fewer alcoholic drinks a day, and for men, two or fewer alcoholic drinks a day. And here's a serving of alcohol. And this is 1.5 ounces of hard liquor, 5 ounces glass of wine, or 12 ounces of beer. So just for real life, I always tell my patients, if you're going to drink, you've got to eat. And you have to eat some substantial food with carbohydrate in it. And it can cause low blood sugar, especially if your patients have hypoglycemia unawareness. You have to counsel them endlessly about alcohol causing low blood sugar. They may be, if you're drunk, you have a hard time feeling low blood sugar. And if you already have unawareness, you're at such high risk. So it can worsen neuropathy and also increase triglycerides. So that's alcohol. Let's keep going. So when we think about successful weight loss strategies, we want to base it on evidence, what really is going to help people lose weight with diabetes, because I've mentioned that losing weight early on seems to be very effective at protecting the beta cells. So just losing 4 pounds, 4 to 8 pounds early on can be very beneficial. And so I always ask my patients, is losing weight one of your goals? You know, my patients who come in are mostly overweight, and they can say, yes, it is one of my goals. And then we start talking about weight loss strategies, eating breakfast, weigh yourself once a week. This is all common sense to us, but every patient resonates with one or more of these. You know, hopefully they'll resonate with one of these. I just had a gal, we just said she ate chips every day for lunch. A bag of chips. Her and her husband would sit down and watch her favorite show and eat chips. So I go, let's just make one goal. Let's just don't buy the chips. And she actually came up with that goal, not me. And I saw her about a month later, and she's like, I've lost 20 pounds. Was it the chips that helped? Sure, the chips helped, but it was also, she chose a goal that was achievable for her, and she achieved it. And with that success, she goes, I can get rid of other junk food. It was pretty amazing. So when people find that they succeed, it kind of motivates them to keep going. Use meal replacements. So these are things like, the Jenny Craig meals, or maybe having a Glucerna. I don't really like Glucerna, so I'm just saying this because I rather them eat the food. But some patients like, you know what, if I have a Glucerna instead of lunch, it's calorie controlled, and I can help reduce my overall intake. Sometimes that is more important, is losing weight might be the most important thing at that moment for that patient. And so we're going to have to, do some adjustments. And going to Weight Watchers really seems to help for patients eating healthy foods. I've talked about this already. Losing 2 to 8 kilograms early in diagnosis is so helpful with type 2 diabetes. And this is important to know for the exam. To lose 1 pound, you have to eat 3,500 calories less. 3,500 calories less. Plus, exercise. Now, exercise may not directly help people lose weight, but it will help them maintain weight loss. This is kind of controversial. Does exercise cause weight loss by itself? Well, you have to exercise. You'll see different numbers, but at least 1 to 2 hours of vigorous activity a day to lose weight. And then you would have to eat the same. Many people, when they exercise, eat more because their appetite increases. So to lose weight, I like to focus on eating less calories, and exercise will help maintain the weight loss. That's how I word it. You know how important exercise is. We'll get to it in a minute. So I'm not saying it's not important. It's vital, but it doesn't always equal weight loss. It's eating less food that will cause the weight loss, which, of course, as you know, is one of the hardest things to do. Bariatric surgery. Bariatric surgery has been around a long time. When I was a nurse, a new grad, 30 years ago. How did I get so old, by the way? Oh, well, it's good. It's good I'm alive. I'm happy. But when we did bariatric surgeries, I remember doing those 30 years ago. It kind of went out of favor for a while, and in the last 10 to 15 years, they've really made a comeback. And the American Diabetes Association has said, you know what? This might be an option for people with a BMI of 35 or greater. And this is the American Diabetes Association and also the American Academy of Clinical Endocrinology. They both say this. Consider bariatric surgery as an option. It does increase gut hormone availability, but these patients, you know, their world becomes a lot more complicated after bariatric surgery. They need lifelong support, medical monitoring, and you will hear patients say, well, this bariatric surgery is going to cure my diabetes. That's actually an inaccurate statement. It is more likely to cause remission. Now, what does remission mean? This is important for us to know. Remission means blood glucose level are at level normal. That's not right. Normal levels without medications, so that the blood glucose levels normalize without medications. It doesn't mean the diabetes gone away. It doesn't mean they're cured from their diabetes. It means their blood sugars have normalized without medications. And the truth is, there's remission. Within 5 years, you'll see that 68% of patients do have some remission of their diabetes for 5 years. But 35% redevelop diabetes. So within that five-year period, you know, we'll see a lot of them have remission, but about one-third of them redevelop their diabetes and their blood sugars go up. And, you know, as patients gain weight after the surgery, the risk of their blood sugars going up increases. The other thing I do want to say, and I'll move on, but the earlier you catch the person in the course of their diabetes, the more likely the surgery is to be effective. So the more beta cell mass they have, when they undergo the surgery, the more likely they are to have success with improvement in blood sugars. The other thing I want to talk about is, I'm just looking at if I have a poll question coming up. I do in a minute. Celiac disease. Celiac disease has appeared on the exam, so you want to be familiar with it. It affects about 10% of people with type 1. It's an autoimmune condition. And it's an immune reaction to gluten, and that's found in wheat and other, it's the protein in the wheat. And it affects the villi, the function of the villi in the intestine. So here's healthy villi, and you can see there's these little crypts and holes where the nutrients can be absorbed. And they're, if you looked at them under a microscope, they're floating around. But you can see here's disease. The villi are just non-functional. So it's really a malabsorption situation where when the villi are exposed to this gluten, they have an inflammatory response, and they kind of freeze up. And so patients then have malabsorption expression, and they might have bloating, weight loss, fatty stools, diarrhea, muscle tenderness, losing weight. And I've seen actually celiac disease happen in patients who've had type 1 for 30 years. So it can happen during the course at any moment of diabetes. All of a sudden, they're losing weight, their blood sugars are wacky, they can't figure out why. You know, and especially if they're complaining of GI symptoms, yeah, we should think about gastroparesis, but really consider celiac disease. How do we diagnose it? Well, we look at these, at the tissue transglutaminase, or we can look at the anti-endomysial autoantibodies, the EMA titers, but usually we use this transglutaminase. And if it comes back positive and they are expressing this autoimmunity, we go ahead and do a biopsy of their intestines to confirm diagnosis. And that's, you know, of course, a GI specialist. So these patients have to be gluten-free for life. They have to avoid wheat, rye, barley. Definitely get them to see a dietitian. Oatmeal sometimes appears on this list, but it's usually oatmeal because in the processing, it might be contaminated by a wheat product. So oatmeal is kind of a fence sitter, but for sure, wheat, rye, and barley is what we want our patients to avoid. And you want to make sure they see a dietitian who's familiar with celiac disease to help get them on the right course. And here's some just examples of gluten-containing foods. You can see it's so hard to figure out, you know, what food does have gluten in it and to avoid that. And so now the new labeling laws are really helping people with celiac disease because it makes it much more clear which foods do contain these. And I just put some resources for you on celiac disease. Let's just, we're going to move on to gastroparesis. But before I do, John has gastroparesis. What is the best recommendation for him? Eat raw vegetables and limit fruit. Eat low fiber, small meals. Always take insulin after meals. Or avoid foods containing wheat. So let me launch that poll. Okay, 84% of you voted. Thank you, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share what you said. So nobody chose eat raw vegetables and limit fruit. Great job, you guys, because raw vegetables have a lot of fiber and it's going to slow things down. With gastroparesis, everything is slowed down because the innervation of the stomach is really minimal. And so the stomach doesn't move its content forward. 81% of you chose the right answer. Eat low fiber, small meals. Exactly right. So with gastroparesis, this is hard for us to say because we're always talking about fiber, eating fiber. But in this situation, we're going to have to cut back on the fiber, small frequent meals. Now, this one was kind of the trick question C, always take insulin after meals, because it is true with a lot of my patients with gastroparesis. I will say, you know what, since the food takes a while to absorb, let's give your insulin post-meal, and that way you'll have less problem with hypoglycemia. So, but the trick of this question was always take insulin after meals. So it's not always, not all people need to do that, and it wouldn't be all of the time. So if I change this to say, some patients may benefit from taking insulin after the meals, it would have more chance of being right. But it's not right in the way I've written it. 7% of you said avoid foods containing wheat. That's celiac disease. So just make sure that I just talked about celiac disease, so that's in your mind, but we're talking right now about gastroparesis. So read the question carefully. Look at the main intent. Gastroparesis, we know what that is. There's not good nerve innervation of the stomach. What does that patient need to do? Low fiber, small meals. Okay, great job. 81% of you guys got that right. Excellent. Okay, so I've talked about gastroparesis already, so I can kind of just summarize key points on this slide. Patients with gastroparesis, different than celiac disease, will complain of early satiety, fullness, and they'll get postprandial low blood sugar and vomiting. So they eat, they feel like they have a rock in their stomach, nauseated, they're belching after they eat, just very uncomfortable. And so you can see what the treatment is. The number one treatment actually is getting blood sugars down. When you get blood sugars down, the stomach can wake up a little bit again. So that's the number one treatment for gastroparesis, in addition to low fiber foods and eating frequent small meals. We really want to get to the root of the problem. Let's take a look at Joan. Joan has type 1 diabetes. She teaches aerobics. She has a BMI of 17. Her fasting blood glucose is 312 to 380. Which of the following is most important intervention to improve her diabetes control? Which is the most important intervention to improve her diabetes control? Eat a 15-gram carb snack before teaching class. Acknowledge that hyperglycemia signifies end of honeymoon period. Refer to mental health professional or increase the basal dose of insulin. Let me go ahead and launch this. Wow, you guys are voting fast on this one. You both have, all of you who are voting, not both of you, but there's two answers that are competing for the right one. It's just like watching a horse jump out of the stall at a race. I'm going to tell you all something right now, and that is we're not going to end on time today, and I'm not willing to rush. So we are probably going to end 10 minutes, go over by 10 minutes, but you can always listen to the remainder, the recorded version, because I want to make sure to cover this content in a meaningful way. And if you can stay, great. But I just have a commitment to all of you to share this information in a way that's helpful. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. 84% of you have voted. Let's talk about this for a minute, because this is a very interesting question to me. Joan has type 1 diabetes. She teaches aerobics with a BMI of 17. So right away, you have to know, what does that signify, a BMI of 17? Is she normal weight, overweight, underweight? And so you need to be familiar with the BMI categories. So I know the dietitians out there know immediately she is underweight. So anytime you see a type 1 who's underweight, physically active, teaching aerobics, very lean, and her blood sugars are high, there's one thing I'm worried about, and I'll tell you what that is. It's disordered eating. If her fasting blood sugars, I'm not just saying once they run 300, they've been running 312 to 380. This person's in danger. And it's really looking at her relationship with her diabetes. She's underweight. Her blood sugars are high. So I know her diabetes is not well controlled. If I could give you her A1C, you know, it's 13% at least. So what is the most important intervention to improve her diabetes control? Is it eat a 15-gram snack before teaching class? No, that's not going to help. That's not going to help her fasting at all. So you want to get to the root of the question. What is the key intent? The key intent is her fasting's high. What are we going to do to improve that? And eating a snack before class would definitely not improve that. Acknowledge this signifies the end of the honeymoon period? Probably not. I mean, the honeymoon period lasts for 1 or 2 years after you have diabetes, and she's, been on insulin for a long time. So it's not the honeymoon period. So the honeymoon period means when your pancreas producing cells run out of insulin, and that usually happens pretty quickly after diagnosis. So 23% of you said refer to a mental health professional. That is the right answer, because I'm suspicious that Joan has an eating disorder. And on the test, will they have questions like this? Yeah. So it's kind of really thinking through what's going on with this person, more than just her blood sugar. So you have to now connect blood sugars to BMI and her situation. Those two together make me suspicious of an eating disorder. D, increase basal insulin dose. She probably could use more basal insulin, but she's probably not even taking enough insulin, because she has probably something, I'm going to keep going, called diabulimia. So diabulimia is most common in girls with type 1 diabetes. Some people say up to 30% of women with type 1 diabetes, girls with type 1 diabetes have it. It can also happen to boys. How do we define this? Well, with any disordered eating, people, you know, see there's a mismatch between the person's body weight and how they see themselves. And so what we'll see is that, and if type 1, they give themselves less insulin than they need to lose weight. So what they do, instead of taking their Novolog before every meal and their basal insulin at night, they might just skip their insulin for a few days or just take a little bit of basal, let their blood sugars run high to lose weight, and they can lose weight very quickly. Tends to start in adolescence, more likely to occur in women than men. What are some of the signs? Unexplained blood sugar spikes, A1C high, weight loss, not checking blood sugars, not refilling their medications, records they might be falsifying their records to please a healthcare provider, but their A1C is very high. So if you're suspicious of this, really the main treatment is complicated treatment, but get them into a mental health professional as soon as possible, someone who specializes in that, in eating disorders, because this is a serious problem. With diabetes and diabulimia, it can lead to gastroparesis and all kinds of very serious complications. And I really want to say this, it's not a knowledge deficit, it's a mental health issue, because these people know diabetes better than anyone else. As my colleague Dina says, if they know more than you do about nutrition and exercise, and they're exercising all the time, you are going to look for signs of disordered eating. So I just said, know these facts for the exam. I just put a few things that I've seen in the exam in the past, and I've covered most of these already. The other thing I want to mention is 10,000 steps is recommended a day, and 2,000 steps equals a mile. So that is coming under the exercise category. So let's go ahead and move on to exercise. Thank you so much, everyone, and we'll keep going. So physical activity, some key areas. And again, what I did is I went through the outline and I said, what does the outline say you all need to be familiar with for the exam? And I just kind of based my talk and content on that. And this is from the exercise recommendations found in the standards of care, and also the exercise recommendations. I put it on your resource list by the American Diabetes Association. But we need to know this. Children with diabetes or adults with diabetes, okay, children with type 1 or type 2 diabetes, sorry about that, it's typo, should be encouraged to engage in at least 60 minutes of physical activity a day. So kids with type 1 or type 2 should be out there moving 60 minutes a day to help regulate blood sugars. Adults with diabetes, 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity aerobic physical activity. And very important here, spread over at least 3 days a week and don't miss more than 2 consecutive days of exercise. So don't do Monday and then do Friday and Saturday. You want to at least do it 3 times a week and don't miss more than 2 days. In absence of contraindications, type 2 adults, very important, should engage in resistance training 2 times a week. What does resistance training mean? It means weightlifting, because they've shown that that increases muscle mass and also helps improve glucose control. So I just like to go over some definitions with you, and we'll talk about resistance training more. Physical activity, how do they define it? This is kind of the general category. It's bodily movement produced by the contraction of skeletal muscles that requires more energy than when resting. So I always say my definition of physical activity is any movement off the couch. That's my definition. So we want to get people up and moving around. Exercise is more committed. It's a subset of physical activity that's planned, structured, and includes repetitive body movements, and it's performed to maintain physical fitness. For some reason, they had sedentary behavior described, so I thought I'd throw it in there for you. No movement or physical activity. So you all know the benefits of exercise. I tell people it's like taking insulin. I mean, when you exercise, your muscles just suck up glucose. It improves insulin sensitivity. It's going to increase your metabolic consumption of glucose, because your body needs glucose and that fuel to move forward. It reduces cardiovascular risk factors, maintains weight loss, you feel better, muscle strengthening, and look at this, so important, slows decline in mobility. What are we most fearful of? Our older patients, falls, not having good balance. So keeping up that muscle mass improves your mobility. It's so important. And I'll add one that's not on the list from the ADA, in that it helps decrease dementia and Alzheimer's. Importance of exercise with diabetes. It's not only a vital component of managing type 2, it's a vital component of prevention. And it has greatest impact in improving metabolic abnormalities when started early. We keep talking about this. Lose weight early, early in the process of the disease. Get the blood sugars down early, and exercise started early. Even in the stages of insulin, IR means insulin resistance, to prediabetes, to diabetes, very important to help slow the progression. Activity helps protect your beta cells. It's worth it. And for type 1s, we really want to emphasize adjusting insulin to allow for safe participation. So for our type 1s, it's a lot trickier. It's going to take a lot of problem solving, trial and error to figure out, you know, what insulin is going to match them based on their activity. What carbohydrates do they need based on their activity? So for type 1s, they're going to need a lot of ongoing coaching to help them do this successfully. Type 2s, a little bit less because they still make insulin and they're resistant, so they're less likely to run into problems. So why is progressive resistant exercise so important? It improves insulin sensitivity, it improves muscle mass, it improves balance, it does a lot of great stuff. So the goal here, and I would be familiar with these goals, 2 sessions a week, each session consisting of at least 1 set of 5 or more resistant exercises using large muscle groups. So that's what we're trying to help our patients achieve. So getting those barbells that you have by your on your couch, so when you're watching TV, you can do five sets of these resistant activities using your arms or your legs, something to help improve the muscle mass. Okay, we're going to do another poll question, and this looks at ADA guidelines and who needs a graded exercise test with EKG. So in the past, we used to say, well, if you have diabetes, before you start exercising, you've got to get a stress test. And they found out that that was a big limiting factor for a lot of our patients, and it wasn't necessary. It didn't improve outcomes. So now they have a list, a description of who does need a graded exercise test with an EKG. Is it A, our 25-year-old overweight female, diabetes for 5 years, B, our 30-year-old male, type 2 diabetes, BMI, he's obese, 38-year-old male, type 1 for 10 years, history of retinopathy, or our 38-year-old obese woman with a history of GDM? So of all of these people, even if you haven't memorized the chart that I've included in your handout, just based on your knowledge and experience, who will be at the biggest risk for vascular disease and who it might be kind of dangerous for them to exercise without being evaluated first? Okay, good job, everybody. Thank you for voting. I'll be staying today to answer your questions after the webcast. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. Okay, I'm going to share this with you. So nobody chose the first one. And that is a 25-year-old overweight female with diabetes. You're right, because she's very low risk for problems happening. 12% of you chose a second one, which is a 30-year-old male with type 2 diabetes, BMI of 31. And I'm thinking you chose him because of his BMI, but we're not getting any other cardiovascular risk factors associated with him. He's under the age of 40, so he actually is one of our lower risk people. But 84% of you chose the right answer, and that is a 38-year-old male with type 1. So I just want to say, whenever you see in a description a patient has retinopathy, that tells you that that patient has vascular disease throughout their body. If you have retinopathy, new blood vessel growth in your eyes, it tells me that there's been significant hyperglycemia and that the body has been affected by that hyperglycemia, in particular the blood vessels. If the patient has nephropathy, I know their blood vessels are also affected, and they're at risk for heart disease. So anytime you see a patient that has retinopathy, nephropathy, neuropathy, we know there's been a vascular impact in the body, and their risk for cardiovascular disease is actually a little bit higher. So that was the right answer. But I just want to talk about pre-exercise evaluation for type 2. In asymptomatic patients, wait, let me just say one more thing. this will be on the exam. In some way, they're going to ask you about safety, cardiovascular safety for patients. So this will be really excellent to be familiar with. But for type 2 and asymptomatic patients, routine screening is not recommended. But we want to assess cardiovascular risk factors annually. And here they are. Dyslipidemia, hypertension, smoking. This was interesting. Positive family history of premature coronary disease. So just if the person walks in with that, we know they're a little bit higher risk, and we need to address that. And albuminuria. So they're spilling protein through their urine. That tells me they're higher risk for vascular disease. Candidates for advanced or invasive cardiac testing include anybody who has atypical or typical cardiac symptoms, or if they did a resting EKG and it's abnormal, they better go for a stress test. So during our pre-exercise evaluation, we want to use our clinical judgment when making physical activities suggestions and check in with the provider if we're not sure. You know, for most of our patients, starting with a low-intensity, short activity seems to be pretty safe. But if you're just getting, like if your patient has a lot of those cardiovascular risk factors, you want to proceed with caution and double check with the provider and make sure it's okay to recommend this walking program. But definitely, we're going to be more cautious with certain types of exercise if they have uncontrolled hypertension, peripheral neuropathy, lesions, unstable proliferative retinopathy. And basically what this is saying, if I have retinopathy, you don't want to lift weights or have patients bending over. If they have a history of peripheral neuropathy and foot problems, maybe walking is not a good idea for them because that would be too much stress on their feet. Maybe we need to find a different activity for them. So we want to be thoughtful about matching patients' activity to what they present with. So here's the recommendations when to consider stress testing. And again, I just got this from the article, Exercise and Type 2 Diabetes. And you can see that, in general, EKG stress testing may be indicated for anybody over the age of 40 with risk factors for diabetes. I'm sorry, with cardiovascular risk factors other than diabetes. And age 30 and older, if they've had diabetes for more than 10 years duration. And just in general, if you have diabetes after 10 years, the risk of complications goes up. So that's a good rule of thumb to know, especially if the A1C has been elevated. But additionally, if they have any of these other risk factors, we want to be very cautious. And any of the following, regardless of age, we want to do more testing, where they're more likely to need testing. Testing. If they have CAD, vascular disease, PAD, autonomic neuropathy, or nephropathy with renal failure, because remember what I was saying earlier, if you have kidney or nerve disease or eye disease, you have vascular disease. So patients to discuss symptoms with provider before starting exercise. So patients need to let their provider know, do they have chest pain or shortness of breath, leg cramps, which is intermittent claudication that go away with rest, head, shoulder, neck, and our back aches. Though any unexplained pain above the belt line should be considered cardiac in origin until proven otherwise. I've had so many patients, or just like a handful, come in to see me and complain of, you know, kind of pain in their back, pain between their shoulder blades, you know, pain when they walk. They have vascular disease, and I want them to get further evaluation to see if they're not having some angina or arterial disease. The thing with peripheral arterial disease, let me go back, is that we know their vessels are compromised and they're more likely to have sudden death during exercise. So we're cautious. So I'm not trying to say don't encourage people to exercise. No, I'm saying kind of screen your patients during your assessment and figure out who's high risk and see if we need to do further testing. And for the lower risk patients, proceed with, you know, slowly. Proceed slowly. It's not, you know, just you haven't exercised for 20 years. Don't run a marathon. Start a walking program. Okay, next question. What best describes normal hormone response during exercise? This is somebody without diabetes. Just what would normally happen in the body as far as hormone response during exercise? I'll go ahead and read the answers with you. A, insulin and counter-regulatory hormones are suppressed, B, insulin levels increase, gluconeogenesis decreases, C, insulin action is suppressed, increased gluconeogenesis, D, increase in insulin and increase in uptake of glycogen. What's the right answer? Okay, 52% of you have voted. Great job, everybody. 76. This is a hard question because I use a lot of big words. And I don't usually use big words, but the reason I put these big words, you know, quote unquote big words in there, is these words do show up on the exam, so you need to be familiar with these particular vocabulary words. So I'm going to go ahead and close this. But the other thing I do want to say is that when you get into the big word situation, just try and break them down and figure out what it's really talking about and translate it into English for yourself. So just reword it in a more common language way, and that seems to help me too. I'm like, okay, this means that and that means that. So let's go through this together because we had a lot of variation in their responses. So when you exercise, what happens? So just let's think about exercise for a minute. Your muscles need energy. Your muscles need energy, right, when you exercise. So during exercise, you need to liberate glycogen stores. You need to create energy through gluconeogenesis. When you exercise, you are liberating glycogen stores and increasing glucose to feed your muscles. Super important. And when you exercise, insulin levels are suppressed because you need to have glucose available. Insulin action is suppressed, so blood sugars can rise. You don't want to store energy, you want to release energy. So maybe that helped you all think through this. What would be the right answer? Do you need to know this for the exam? Yes. On the exam, they always ask about normal hormone response to exercise in some way. I've taken the exam, as you know, 5 times, and it always comes up some version of it. So just be familiar with this. Okay, so A is the wrong answer because it says insulin and counter-regulatory hormones are suppressed. Because when you exercise, counter-regulatory hormones are increased. Stress hormones are released when you exercise. A is the wrong answer. So B, you know, is the wrong answer because I just told you insulin levels decrease. So this says increase. So B is the wrong answer. Now, what does this word gluconeogenesis mean? Creation of new glucose. Gluco, sugar, neo, new, genesis, creation. So gluconeogenesis does not decrease during exercise. It increases. You need fuel. Wrong answer. C, insulin action is suppressed and there's increased gluconeogenesis. Okay, I'm liking this answer, right? Because I suppress insulin, increase glucose availability through gluconeogenesis. I think that's the right one. Let's keep going. D, increase in insulin and increase in uptake of glycogen. Wrong. When you exercise, insulin is lowered, glycogen stores are released. So the right answer is C. What if you got that question wrong? Just you know, in the ADA standards of care and in the art and science book, they talk about normal physiology of exercise. You could take a look at that. And I'm going to cover it more in the handouts. Oh, look at here it is. Here's the answer right here. Exercise effects on blood glucose if you don't have diabetes. Insulin action suppressed. Counter-regulatory hormones are increased. You release more glycogen from your muscle and liver, and gluconeogenesis is also increased. And this is interesting. After you exercise, it takes about 48 hours to replenish your glycogen stores. That's why that's normal physiology, but for our people with diabetes, we often say this, that when you exercise, it affects your blood sugar for up to 2 days, because it does, because your muscles have really utilized that glucose. So if you have type 1 diabetes, this is a really an important point, so I'm going to spend some time on it. And I already mentioned I'm going to go over today, but I really want to go over this information. So I understand if you have to leave, Great. Thank you so much for joining us. But if you could stay, I'm going to just go over this and talk about exercise for a little while longer. Hormone response for type 1. Exogenous insulin remains high. So exogenous, what does that mean? It means coming from the outside. So with type 1s, they inject insulin. They can't take it out. Once they inject it, it's in there. So they have injected insulin. Insulin is not suppressed because they injected it. So you can see what they're at risk for, hypoglycemia, because that insulin's still floating around even though they need it to be suppressed. They can't do it. They don't have the hormones that regulate it. They also have increased insulin sensitivity and absorption. So you can see for type 1s how tricky it is to prevent hypoglycemia when exercising. So what strategies to stay safe? Well, again, I mentioned this earlier, they're going to have to really become familiar with how their body responds to exercise and how to adjust insulin beforehand and cover with carbs. We'll talk, I have some slides on this too. So what about our type 2s? Decreased secretion of endogenous insulin. So they're making less endogenous insulin during exercise, which might not be too bad. Unless they're really insulin deficient, then they can cause a little bit of problems. But for most of our patients with type 2, we're just so thrilled that they are making less insulin during this exercise, because it does two great things. It increases insulin sensitivity and glucose disposal. So for our type 2s, this really works out to their benefit because they really get those blood sugars down. So hypoglycemia risk. Our type 1s are absolutely at risk. Activity increases the insulin they injected, the sensitivity, and may block glycogenolysis. So when you have external insulin coming in, the liver doesn't liberate the glycogen stores. That's why they're at such high risk for low blood sugar. The type 2s have the same concern if they're on insulin or sulfonylureas, but if they're not on those medications, they have a low risk for hypoglycemia because they're not going to get low blood sugar if they're not on those medications. So they're much have a bigger safety profile for exercise. Duration of hypoglycemia risk. How long does that risk of hypoglycemia last? Well, certainly it depends on the duration and intensity of the exercise, but immediately after exercise is a real high risk time. But there's a lot of situations where hours later they'll get hypoglycemia, because remember I said it takes a while for the muscles and the liver to replenish their glycogen stores, so they're still storing extra energy. So most likely to happen in type 1s, often at night, especially if there was high intensity activity. 4 to 15 hours after an exercise session, we're going to be more cautious and monitoring the blood sugars more carefully. That's really important to know. If I have a type 2 who's on sulfonylureas or insulin and they're out raking leaves all day, I know they're at risk for hypoglycemia later that night. So they need to know too. We want to just help our patients be safe and get the best blood glucose control too. How do we prevent hypoglycemia? If planned activity, adjust insulin if in anticipation of activity. So I have had patients before they exercise, on the days they go to the gym, let's decrease your bolus insulin by 1 or 2 units. A lot of super athletes with type 1 diabetes are on an insulin pump. They decrease their basal rate because they know they become so much more insulin sensitive. They need a lot less. So we want to just think about different strategies to help prevent low blood sugar, frequent monitoring after exercise period, and then patient to keep detailed log, that's so important. And then always carry fast acting carb, and for our type 1s, a glucagon emergency kit in case of severe low. And then thinking about extra carbohydrates in the post-exercise period, and if they're, you know, of drinking age, really talking about the relationship between exercise and alcohol, how that could seriously potentiate hypoglycemia. So we also can think about adjusting carbohydrate. In addition to adjusting insulin, we may say, why don't you take an extra carbohydrate prior to planned activity? 15-gram carb snack if using insulin or secretagogues. If they're on metformin, they don't need a snack. They don't need to do that. But if their blood glucose is less than 100 prior to exercise, definitely considering a 15-gram carbohydrate snack. And here I have this kid drinking milk, an easy way to get some carbohydrates in before exercise. And so here I have a really nice slide that my colleague Dana Armstrong shared with me, looking at carbohydrate replacement during physical activity. This is really good to know for the exam, and it's also really good to know for real life. If the intensity is mild to moderate and it's less than 30 minutes, maybe they don't need carbohydrate replacement, especially if they're type 2. Type 1s, if their blood sugar was low before exercise, they may need something. But moderate activity, 15 grams each hour, and high activity, they might need 30 to 50 grams each hour of carbohydrate to prevent hypoglycemia. Now, what about hyperglycemia? Is there a risk for that during exercise? For our type 1s, yeah, if there's not enough insulin on board and there's excessive stress hormones. So for our type 1s, they don't have enough insulin on board. They're releasing a lot of counter-regulatory hormones, which can crank up their blood sugars, and they are at higher risk for hyperglycemic crisis, maybe even ketoacidosis. So making sure they have some insulin on board, because we know they're going to release those counter-regulatory hormones, and it might cause hyperglycemia. This is really true during, you know, very high intensity exercise, competitive sports. It really takes a lot of trial and error to evaluate what is the right insulin dose. So ketone testing, do we want to test ketones? Because you've heard, if you're ketone positive, don't exercise. So what we say is don't exercise for type 1s if their blood glucose is more than 240 and they're ketone positive. For type 2s, more than 300 and ketone positive. So we can measure ketones using a meter, or we can use it measure using urine. This is a typo, so please fix this. I'll fix this on the handout. But if there's positive ketones, exercise not recommended. Not recommended. It can worsen hyperglycemia and ketosis. If negative ketones, you can go ahead and exercise, but keep hydrated, because when your blood sugars are high, you're more likely to get dehydrated. So really, really important. So that concludes the exercise part, and I just want to spend a few minutes going over behavior change and SMART goals. This was a special request by Ugo, so I wanted to honor Ugo and just spend maybe 5 minutes looking at some behavior change, SMART goals, and looking at some learning theories too. But let's just take a poll question number 8. Which of the following is a learning objective? Record food intake for 1 month, identify carbohydrate food each meal, drink non-caloric beverages instead of soda, or eat 3 servings of carb at dinner. Which of the following is a learning objective? And this comes into play when we're looking at setting behavioral goals or learning objectives. And we do both of those during our one-on-one assessment with our patients. All right. Thanks for voting, everybody. Well, you guys are rocking it today. I'm going to go ahead and close that and share it with you. So recording food intake for 1 month is more of a behavioral goal. It is tempting because you're writing it down as a behavioral goal. So identifying carbohydrate food each meal is more of a learning objective. So it's a little bit close, but the better answer is definitely B, because it's more of a learning objective as opposed to a behavioral goal. So B is the right answer, and 86% of you chose that. So good job, everyone. I do want to just talk about these next few slides, and then we'll wrap up. But when we look at setting goals, we want to make sure they're SMART. I'm sure you've heard of this: specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. And I just put an example of a behavioral goal that matches all of these. Count and document carb intake at each meal for 2 weeks. So it's specific. You can measure it. It's attainable for this particular patient. It's realistic, and it's time-oriented. Here would be a learning objective. Describe portion size for a favorite type of carbohydrate. That's more of a learning objective versus a behavioral goal. And so they might ask questions about these two on the exam, so I wanted to share the difference between that for all of you. And when we want to consider our client's view on health, we want to look at the different theories that are available. And I'm going to just talk briefly about four theories that you want to be familiar with: patient empowerment, health belief theory, social learning, and trans-theoretical. And empowerment theory is what we've been talking about this entire boot camp, and that is really engaging patients to learn, engaging patients in their self-care. 99% of diabetes is self-care, and ultimately the responsibility rests on the person with diabetes. The person with diabetes is an expert in their own life. The healthcare professional is an expert in clinical aspects. So the empowerment says self-goals, freely chosen, more successful, they last longer, and the patient has more self-responsibility. That's why empowerment is so important. It's the other side of compliance. Compliance says do this, do this. Empowerment, the patient generates their goals and their direction. We coach and support them along the way. We want to focus on behaviors, not outcomes. This is so important to us. When a patient comes in and they bring their blood glucose log, we don't want to say, wow, you have a lot of high blood sugars. We want to say, wow, I am really impressed. You're writing down your blood sugars once, twice a day. You kept a record and you brought it into me. Focus on behaviors. Very important. Involve family and use a step-by-step approach. Now, the health belief model is a little bit different. It says, hey, what they believe matters. So we know that behavior is influenced by four perceptions: how susceptible they feel to the disease or to getting, you know, complications of diabetes, how serious or severe do they think it is, are there benefits of taking care of themselves, and is it worth it? Is it worth it to check my blood sugars and take the medication and go to the gym? Does the benefit outweigh the cost? We're always doing that. Is it worth it for me to do this? What's in it for me? How really vulnerable am I to getting complications? So patients are always going to negotiate that, and we want to hear what they're thinking and really help them move in the direction that's best for what they're able to do. Now, the third theory is social learning. Social learning theory says, hey, we learn from others, and we're motivated by others, or it's not really the right word. We're influenced by others. And so it's an interaction between people around us, the environment, and what we're able to do. And we do a lot of observational learning. And this is really true in support groups and in classes where you teach group classes. You'll see they're teaching each other all the time. They're like, oh, you do that? I could do that. And so that's social learning theory, the best description. Anytime you have a group class, patients learn from each other. And the last one here is a trans-theoretical model. It sounds complicated, but it's not. It just tells us that patients are in different places of learning. Pre-contemplation is, well, they're not really thinking about making changes. Contemplation, they're considering it. Preparation, they're getting ready. Action, they're doing it. Maintenance, they're just rolling with it. And termination is, they're just burned out. Oh, I'm sorry about that. And so when our patients are burned out, I just had a class I was talking to patients with. I go, guys, you know, diabetes does last a long time, and you might run into a place where you're really struggling and you're having a hard time maintaining this. We're here to help you. You know, we have support groups. You can give us a call to let people know that they may reach a point where they need to be reengaged and supported again. And so, simplified version of the stages of change: they're not ready, unsure, or they're ready. And so depending on where the patient is at, we're going to support them wherever they are and provide them with the resources and information they need at that moment. So that kind of wraps up our last boot camp. As usual, I will stay for questions. And I really want to tell you guys, it's been such a pleasure working with you, and I'm feeling very positive about your success with this exam. And I just want to go over some last minute things to help you succeed. Know how to get to the testing site. Get a good night's sleep the night before. I don't know if you, some people like to cram the night before, some people don't. Whatever you do, just get some sleep. Get some sleep the night before. Have somebody rub your back or rub your back yourself. Get relaxed and really get some good sleep. During the test, we don't care if you look funny. Get up and move around. Stand up. Stretch. Do anything you can to keep your brain fresh. It's a four-hour exam. You need to move around, or otherwise, you know, it's difficult. And make sure to eat before you take that exam. I have this, put your hands on your hips. Putting your hands on your hips helps you get focused, lowers your adrenaline, and increases your testosterone. Afterward, celebrate, treat yourself. Whatever the result is, say, man, you work so hard at this. You are going to go out and just treat yourself to something nice. You deserve it. If you wouldn't mind jotting down your impressions of the exam and emailing it to us so we can pass it on, because we pass on what people shared with us to you. And so we like to pass it on, if you wouldn't mind taking a moment. And then when you find out you've passed that exam, we would love to have you send us your photo and some notes, whatever you feel like writing. We want to post you on our website, because we want to start a website of on our website, we want to start a page to show off all of your hard work. So we want to post your picture on there. So email us when you pass, send your picture, and with your permission, we would love to post it. I want to thank you all so much again. I really appreciate your dedication to succeeding at this exam, your dedication to people with diabetes, and I know there's been a lot of personal sacrifice on your behalf. So thank you for that. And I'm going to go ahead and wrap up this last webcast, but I will stay for questions. So take care, everyone, and make sure to let us know how you did. And I am going to send you a questionnaire asking if you would like me to spend an hour going over 50 sample questions so we could see. And then I would go over those 50 sample questions, and we could evaluate how I think through taking a test. And you could hear me talking out loud, and so that would help you to feel more confident with test taking. So think about that if you would like that. One of the students suggested that, and I go, I guess I could go over 50 questions. I mean, it's a lot for you all, but if that would help you, I want to do it. So let me know if you think that would be beneficial. This is Beverly Tomasian. I'm going to stop the recording, but stay for questions. Thanks again.